What was wrong was the idea of the individual, and not because I'm against that idea, but because it's been destroyed. It's been destroyed by the processes of modern capitalism and modern numerical systems, and then most recently financial ones. All of them have sliced us up.
You're listening to the Bielefeld Anthro Book Podcast, featuring new and classic books in anthropology with the authors who are based at Bielefeld University or guest scholars.
I am Lana Emmerling, a student in the Faculty of Sociology and producer of this podcast.
Our guest, Arjun Appadurai, is Emeritus Professor of Media, Culture and Communication at New York University. He has also held professorial chairs at the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Chicago, Yale University, the New School, and New York University. He is the author or editor of 15 books and of more than 150 articles. He is a widely acknowledged expert on globalization, media, cities, and democracy. He currently lives in Berlin and is the 2026 holder of the Niklas Luhmann Visiting Chair in Social Theory at Bielefeld University. Our host, Arjun, is an anthropologist and postdoctoral research associate for the research project Financial Lives at the Faculty of Sociology at Bielefeld University. She received her PhD in social anthropology from the University of Cambridge. Her research focuses on finance, business, and economic life in China.
We're going to be talking about Arjun's not so new but still very refreshing book, Banking on Words. The subtitle is The Failure of Language in the Age of Derivative Finance. This is a very special book that contributes to a broader understanding of the contractual nature of financial products. I think we should start with a very brief reflection on the contents of the book, on how you traced the rise of finance as a discipline and also the financial industry as a rapidly growing system that is getting independent every moment as we're talking, and how you analyze this whole changes the rights of discipline and industry as part of the cultural phenomenon of our society. I think I would like to open the conversation with a brief reflection on the book.
Thank you very much, Hairo. I'm very happy to be in this conversation in the context of my the great honor of being at Bielefeld as the Luhmann Professor in the Sociology Faculty. I am delighted to return to the subject of this book, which appeared in 2016, late in 2016. So it's 10 years old. Time flies. But I believe its issues remain with us. And the broad issues are risk, debt, wealth, and planning, financial planning in ordinary life, as well as in the life of institutions. So, two quick words about what brought me to write this book. One was that the trigger for many of us was the collapse, financial collapse of 2009, which was quite terrifying, even for ordinary people, but also for bankers, investors, central bank heads, anybody who was invested in the financial world. And I was among those people who had a pension to worry about, other things to worry about. And so the question was, what is this collapse? Will I lose everything? Will we lose everything? So that was the personal context. And I was in the U.S. Already in New York when this catastrophe struck. At the same time, I was part of a group of friends and colleagues who felt that anthropologists and others who didn't know much about finance needed to learn so that they could both understand what was happening and contribute to the reduction of the risk of catastrophe and behave like informed citizens in this area, which is highly technical. So we felt that we needed to pool our knowledge. Some of us knew quite a bit about finance. Some of us knew very little. But we found a platform, a discussion group to exchange our knowledge, exchange our ideas. And we produced some collective work also around 2016, 2017, maybe a little later. And my book as my own contribution in 2016, Banking on Words. So the summary is, I was very much like a lay person trying to understand this space, but using my own training and background rather than trying to become a financial analyst or expert.
Thank you very much. It's very interesting to see the problem of finance from a anthropological perspective, because the foundational question, I think it's in the two core essays in this book, which was originally published in journal articles, The Ghost in the Machine and The Spirit of Calculation. Those two articles offered us a very interesting ground to reflect a very foundational question. Where did this belief in the market comes from, which you concluded as a economy based on faith? The faith is something fundamentally can be built on, and the belief in that the market would eventually solve the problem, the market would eventually return back to efficiency, and the market would be allocating the social resources in the best way possible. So I think in the book, this narrative was mostly based on the US-centered financial system, and which was like expanded to other countries because of the hegemony position that the dollar system holds. I'm very interested to know your opinion about how this idea of the faith in the market might also spread or transform to societies who didn't have a long history of developing based on market exchanges or like a market-centered economy. What about the society when this market, this modern financial system was enforced first, and then the society tried to catch up with its rhythm?
Yeah, thank you, Haruo, for that excellent question about the comparative features of the financial system, let's say even in the last 20 years or so, but also the circulating features. What moves, what doesn't move in this financialized order of things? Not everything moves with the same speed, and not everything is taken up either by states or by ordinary citizens in the same way in different parts of the world, such as India, China, Africa, Middle East, outside the Euro-American world. How does that happen? So a very general observation which guided me is the thought of the great Max Weber, who in his time was also asking, how does capitalism move around? What shape does it take in India, in China, in Islam, in Africa? In a way, I'm sitting on his shoulders asking that same question again, except this time about financial markets. He also had another huge influence on me, which I think is quite evident in the book, which is to put the question of religion at the center of the question of the market or economics or entrepreneurship. All of these, he had his very big answer, which is has to do with the Protestant ethic, which is part of his most famous work, which I have read many times. And just for the benefit of our larger audience, to just remind people that the book, his articles, which became a famous book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, that book, which was written around 1904, essentially said that capitalism today is the current crystallization of a very different impulse, which is not economic, calculative, or profit-based originally. That originally it had to do with a sense of being a virtuous individual and appearing so to a Protestant God who had already decided whether you were one of the saved or you were not. So the people in that system had a terrible problem. If you were already determined, then what's the point of anything? Well, the answer was by behaving in the way that that God would like, you at least celebrate him, even if you're not trying to manipulate his decision, which was made already. So there is some paradox there, and there's been a lot of debate, but the simple current value of Weber's thought is that when you see a very big system of economic actions, ideas, ideologies, values, always ask what is the longer, older, deeper cultural or specifically religious environment. And you will always find something. You won't find a zero. So those are, I would say, the contextual thoughts. Finally, I will say, as far as circulation goes, I'm still not so knowledgeable, except based on the work of others, what happens in places like India and China, the Middle East. And I think there are actually huge gaps. Even today, if you say, for example, that somebody in Saudi Arabia is a derivatives trader. He has something that looks like a Bloomberg terminal. He's doing something. But his mindset has been formed in a different way. What do we know about that? And is it that the screen makes him just like his counterpart in Wall Street or in Beijing or in Shanghai or in Delhi or in Bombay? I don't think so. But it's very subtle because the technical common language of financial trading, etc., is very strong, but it doesn't mean everybody brings the same thing to it. So I think that is one path towards a comparative question.
I would like to pick up this topic and to maybe for us to further discuss what might be the difference of people are thinking when they are trading. For example, I think you did a very brilliant job in the book analyzing how financial products and trading was fundamentally future-oriented. So it considers whether a future promise would be continued or broken, which kind of reflects to the broader society, as future has been one of the biggest words at stake. You might have noticed or not, but like recent, a lot of protests from younger generations, they use the slogan of taking back the future a lot in those kind of movements, as if the future has already been taken away or determined. The younger people's future has been taken away, might as well be understood as some sort of a broken promise for their future. And I think this has largely many things to do with the financialization process that put our present most largely already in the arrangement of the trading of future derivatives, of everything has already been insured.
Yes, that is a very important and interesting observation about the future feeling for younger generations and perhaps even for others in different societies as somehow stolen, somehow expropriated in advance or colonized. It's interesting because I think in areas like climate, it's very clear what these younger climate activists and all are saying, that you have taken our future, our planetary future, and wasted it, ruined it, actually. When it comes to the economy, I think, and finance, that view is more nuanced. It is not so clear-cut. But I think there is a worry also that the shaping of the future by major financial instruments, by their protocols and by their tools, has preempted or removed or compelled choices we may not really want to make. So I'll take a simple example. Here in Germany, from the time I arrived here, I noticed that Germans as a whole, I mean, obviously there are differences, but typically don't like debt.
Yeah.
So if you don't like debt, why would you get a mortgage? That has to be sold to you as a good thing. So we are not now talking of China or India. We are talking of Germany, the heart of the Euro-American economic world, where people, for example, don't like credit cards very much. So I'm in the grocery store every day where everybody's taking out
cash,
penny by penny, yes. Not just cash, bitcoins like I use. They bring all the little ones. And people are very patient, the cashiers and so on. It's understood that this is as opposed to getting irritated, why are you bringing all this? So that's all part of a debt issue. So I bring that up to say that when it comes to the future as relevant to the financial markets, there is a double quality. The coin has two sides.
Mm.
One is the side that says we are going to make the future a potential source of profit by making risk profitable. And as I say in the book, that is the revolution of modern finance.
Yes.
It's saying risk is not just something you handle to make profit somewhere else. It is that you take bets on risk itself.
Yes.
So that is, in my view, a kind of revolution. That is the move from economics to finance.
Yes.
In the early 70s, more or less, in the US. And then, of course, it moves around. The results move around. So that is a very tempting thing to say. Now you can not only make money on what you know today about the present or about the past, we have a way to model what's going to happen. And you can also make more money. So it looks like it's expanding the frame. But actually, it is kind of narrowing the frame. It is telling you that the way to take care of your money, the way to invest, the way to plan, the way to secure your future is through this and this. But there may be completely other ways, but they are taken away. So that is the part that is like stealing the future. It's not literally stealing, but narrowing as if this is the way to go. And everybody should invest in stocks, invest in this. Or the huge topic which all of us are affected by, insurance.
By insurance.
100% about the future and how to be safe and this and that. Meanwhile, I look at my own premiums these days. It's like hardly worth it, you know, when I pay this much in order to get a tiny extra if I get sick or if I pass away. But the cost-benefit ratio is becoming very small, you know. So these are, I think, the ambiguities or contradictions in what finance does to our idea of the future. It claims to expand, but actually it contracts.
Contracts, and also insurance companies need to make profits.
Indeed.
They profit from this kind of narrow down options of where your money goes.
In fact, if I may just comment, the insurance is really key historically and I would say socially to the whole financial market business, that it is the precursor. It is where uncertainty is monetized over last 500 years, you know, Lloyd's and so on. They were old history. Before derivatives, before anything, they were saying, well, if you want to send your goods from the UK to Singapore or to Southeast Asia, we will give you insurance policy, but it will cost you this, etc.
Yeah. And this is where the risk has been priced.
Exactly.
And somehow people are pushed into this kind of anxiety of, even if you had cash, your cash might depreciate in the future. So you have to do something with your money to maximize the utility of your money, to put it in the financial system. And I think a very concerning new development of this phenomenon is the development a lot of algorithm-motivated or AI-driven tools to manage the trading of this actually public-funded derivative and the insurance capital market, to the point that it's no longer a human trader who were trying to perform the, as to borrow your words from the book, the rituals to affirm that the future promise will continue. Now it was taken up by the machine. I wonder, how do you understand this kind of phenomenon?
Another major question, I think, not only for us in the social sciences, but also for people in the financial industries or in doing finance PhDs, or who are ordinary citizens using ChatGPT to do this and that. We know everybody is playing around with this stuff, but I believe everybody is on a level playing field because everybody is equally ignorant of what AI could do, might do, will damage or will restrict or might offer. But no one, in my view, is in a strong position to say, look, if you do this, this will happen. If you do that, it's all a guessing game. So the claims of expertise about AI are exaggerated. Of course, human beings need to have some control. So they will try to decide, you know, what is good about, for example, using these either apps or platforms or even the general results from companies like DeepSeek, for example, which is already today having a little less hype compared to before. But this is inevitable. They'll be up, they'll be down. This one has got the answer, that one has got the answer. So I think it's a very unstable environment, but also I always like to repeat what my recently deceased economic anthropologist colleague, Keith Hart. Keith said, I think in some informal way, not even in a book, he said he was talking about the digital world, not finance, but he was talking about the internet, and you know, which he was very interested in. And he said, trying to give a final answer about what digitality will mean for democracy, etc., is a little bit like people in the first 10 years of the agricultural revolution trying to predict all the effects of the plow.
Right.
So, well, it's difficult. It's just come.
Yeah.
So that I also support, but I also believe we have to make decisions. We can't wait and say, let's wait 100 years till AI shows its good and bad qualities, then we will decide. Well, a lot of people will decide before you decide. So you have to have a position. So I do think it's a tricky space. We can't avoid it, but we need to be aware that it's very young, very new, and its potentials, both good and bad, are very poorly understood. But they are massive. That part is true. Even if you take large language models and so on, they are very fast moving, they are very remarkable in their technical capacity. So I'll conclude this response only by saying that I think the whole question of the role of machines and machine-derived tools, algorithms, large databases, etc., is, to me, the big challenge that I see is that while we are constantly looking for machines which will be more like us, that is, that they have feelings and they do this and they do that, so they're not just cognitive machines. This is the great search. But meanwhile, they're making us more like machines.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to know the right prompt. That means I have to become a better machine to help the machine become more like me. So who is becoming more like, which is the tail, which is the dog? So that is my personal view of the dilemma, is how can we have a discussion about humans and machines, which is clear-headed about what are we trying to make, like what? If A is going to be like B, or is B going to be like A?
Yeah.
That will have a lot of effects, you know, which way we go.
This reminded me of quite interesting, the major thing, that this kind of machine-based transformation might do. It's something around the old terrain of anthropology, magics, witchcrafts, as if I think in like the structure that Evans pitch chart maps is like the witchcraft doesn't really change the way that things already happen, but it gives an explanation, it shifts the accountability, which I found greatly similarities from like your what you just analyzed about the AI and machines. I think there are some similar shifts in this. And then does that mean it becomes sort of the magical or a new religion that would shift the way we understand the world or how the society works, because we no longer don't really know how exactly the machine gave us the result, but we know that the result was produced by the machine. And that shift of accountability might actually change the position of machine-driven the financial system or other systems and their position in society and how they change the way we understand things.
Yes, again, a very interesting reminder why it is worth writing books like this, even if they are debated, contested, or whatever, to bring an anthropological point of view to what looks like the opposite of the terrain of anthropology. Because it's so high-tech, it's so abstract, it's so contemporary, we hardly have encountered it.
Yes.
And now we are saying, let's go to New Guinea or let's go here or there. It seems frivolous, but it's, I think, not. First of all, because the very old and basic idea of someone like Marcel Mauss, that objects always carry something of the person's handling them.
Yes.
So the how, as he called it. And that argument of Mauss's in his great short book on the gift was because he was trying to understand the spirit behind the contract. See? So he had a brilliant idea about the contract actually coming out of the gift, and yet they look like the opposite. But today, as I say in the book, the contract is still very important. And that part of the contract, which is promissory, is what has become dangerously expanded in the financial world. So contracts are important because they are the foundation of modern life. So unless we have a completely different society, we have to have agreements. We have to have whether they are written, unwritten, and deliver on them. So we know that contract is the basis of modern society, and Mauss wanted to understand where did this come from. So he wrote that brilliant book as his answer, The Gift. The point, though, is that the contract now has taken this other form, which seems risky and dangerous because it's about future possibilities which may or may not happen. And the instruments involved, derivatives particularly, allow you to move them without facing the consequences of your promise. So somebody else has to live with the promise, and that person then sells it, and yet somebody else. So that is the dynamic I'm trying to capture here. But I do want to go back to the main thrust of your question, which is the link between these kinds of technological devices, which are threatening to overwhelm us, and the relation to machines and tools and technologies in very simple societies also, which is where the issue of magic, ritual, and so on come up. And my main observation there is that long before the digital revolution, I used to teach for years when I first began teaching in a subject which is these days considered, would be considered too unexciting and canonic, anthropology of religion, because these days everybody has some specialized thing. Anthropology, we did religion, family, kinship, like that. So I had to teach that for many years, and I had to talk about magic in that, explain to students what is this business of magic, why we say it's not religion, it's something else, primitive people believe in magic, etc. And I said, well, look at our room, we could do it here. This light goes on. I push something and this comes on. Or I push something and it doesn't come on.
Yes.
But I don't immediately say I need a PhD in electronics. I say it works. Something must have broken down. Somebody will fix it. In short, I understand nothing.
Yes.
But I assume and take for granted, if I speak into this, it will go to, do I know anything about mics, acoustics? Zero. So, in short, 90% of our world, long before digitality, depends on technologies of which we have zero understanding. And once you think of it this way,
yeah.
I open the tap, wow, water. Or worse, no water. So I have to explain both. Or fancier examples are like nuclear disasters. Do I understand anything about Fukushima? Zero. But I know something serious has happened. So in short, what I'm saying is actually our modern relationships to machinic technologies are always largely based on assumptions which are based on some kind of accumulated expertise, but which is not in our hands.
Mm.
I believe that the electricians know and the people in the engineering department know. I don't need to.
Yeah.
I just need to for it to work. And if it doesn't work, get help.
Yeah.
That's all I need.
So like the people who handle the technology are the witches and wizards.
Correct. They're also, you might say, they're experts.
They're experts.
You see? So today, if I want to invest my pension, I go to the experts in the bank. Or I have a bank,
yeah.
And then I realize the bank is not earning enough for me. Of course, I don't understand why, because I know nothing about all these ways of investing money.
Mm.
So then when Merrill Lynch writes to me saying, please give us all your money, we will do better for you, I might go. Not because I know anything, but because among the experts, one person is more persuasive.
Yes.
But the fact is, I understand nothing, but it's no different than I don't understand electricity, I don't understand anything. So we are surrounded with things we don't understand, which means we are not that different from people in small-scale, low-tech, so-called primitive societies who also see a world of things they don't fully understand,
yeah.
Or effects they don't fully understand, which they want to control. See, that is where the technology comes in. If I do this and this and this, the crops will be better, or this will not happen. And when it does not go well, they, like us, do not question the whole cosmology. They say, I rubbed the sticks wrong, or my uncle wished it ill. You know, that's witchcraft.
Yeah.
So they also don't, like us, like all human beings, when they are faced with something problematic, they don't change their entire worldview and say, oh, the whole thing is wrong. There is no God. There is no... They are just some small thing, you know, and get some help from some expert.
Just there. The ritual was wrong.
Exactly. I made a mistake. Somebody made a mistake. Or in the context, the wrong people were present. This is all what the great philosopher whom I mentioned, Austin, called felicity. The conditions were not right. This was supposed to happen only with this kin group, but that stranger was also there. You shouldn't have allowed him. That's why it didn't work, etc., etc.
Yeah. Bird was present.
Exactly, exactly. But nobody questions their worldview unless the evidence is overwhelming and repeated that something is simply not working. But they won't do it quickly and say, oh, something must be wrong with our theory of the world. Who does that?
And then this is, through this very wonderful explanation, I think it's also very interesting to see the opposite. The banks, the bankers, the institutions are also trying to understand people in a similar fashion. They see your pension amount, they see your insurance, they see your monthly income. In order to decide what kind of interest rate they might give you, what kind of products they're going to produce, and in some worst cases, not only they see you as a household, as part of the kinship networks to decide your creditworthiness. And in this system that through your observation, you come up with that concept of individualization.
Yeah.
Because we are evaluated as individuals, we somehow are evaluated as in our profile capped in this system. And you suggested that in order to change, to have our voice heard into this system, we must stand on the perspective of individuals instead of fighting as individuals which is a very progressive and very empowering argument, which I found. And I do would like to invite you to elaborate a bit on that. How do we change the world, change the system as individuals?
Well, that is one of the biggest challenges that my own thinking brought me to. So I came to the, as it were, looking at the edge of it, but I could not fully address it, but I did see it as a direction. And that what was wrong was the idea of the individual. And I said, not because I'm against that idea, but because it's been destroyed. It's been destroyed by the processes of modern capitalism and modern numerical systems, and then most recently financial ones. But all of them have sliced us up. So putting Humpty Dumpty together again is not so easy, especially if you want Humpty to look like the individual that was there in the beginning. That's like taking hundreds of pieces and then saying, which blender will make them whole again? There is no blender. Blenders only cut things up, you know, or they're like these vegetable chopping machines. Therefore, the individual idea for me, just for, again, the benefit of a wider audience, is that we have become an assemblage or site of profiles which are scored. So there is also a numerical element. Mm. It's not just qualitative. In fact, it is usually not qualitative. It's not a number. It's the FICO, the FICO score. That's a number. And I just mentioned on the side, because you are also interested in how these systems move to different societies, that about 10 years ago, I had friends who were trying to make a big entrepreneurial push in India by competing to be the credit rating agencies which are supported by the Reserve Bank, the Central Bank of India. So there was a whole set of businessmen saying, we can do credit scoring for you. Now, India is a tricky place because the databases are very uneven. So some data is great from censuses, etc. Other data is almost zero about family ties, marriage, this, that, poverty, diet. Nobody knows anything. So to do credit scores required some fancy footwork. And of course, everything was relative. You have a product, but this man's product looks better. So now credit scoring is regular in India, but it's still a very young business. Mm. So I give this example to say there is a very specific thing. Do you have reliable technologies for credit scoring? 15 years ago, zero. Banks just did their individual thing. Oh, you're like this. So did you borrow before? Now, there is a heavy data intensive aggregated profile. But in every area, this is what I don't even say enough here, there is no such thing as me. It's me the professor, me the pensioner, me the borrower, me the automobile owner, me the sick or healthy person. Mm. That's all added up to me. But there is no adding. That's a joke. So I am a sum of all these things which are every day growing. So they're not fixed. Like we will score this, we'll score this. Now we have a total score. No, because tomorrow we will score something else. Like what were your smoking habits when you were in high school? Let's compare that with the whole population and what they smoked in high school. Say, think of a place like China. How many people would be under that? How do you see the large data there, the patterns, and how do you fit this person inside it? It's an endless game. So, just to give a shape to that comment, what I would say is the question becomes, can we produce what we would call solidarities, group interests, like we used to talk about class and all. And I say in the book that all of them rested on the architecture of individual. But if individual has been chopped and sliced, what do we do? Give up? No. We could say, let all the credit score people get together. Let all the people who are getting less than 500 in the credit score and will never be able to borrow, get together and say, why did we get 500? Mm. Who decided? And that comes to the banks, you see. That comes to who is doing the using these instruments? And so it's the banks, it's the insurance companies, and often It's also hospitals. It's so the actuarial impulse is everywhere. Everywhere. People are using large data to assess where you fit, etc. So banks are part of that. So there's a history which has been written about by several people, not me, which shows over, say in the US, over a century, what began as anecdotal information. Oh yeah, you are coming here, but your uncle gave you money for your first loan. Now nobody asks. The score is there. And of course, other parts of your credit history, and if they want more, they can always dig deeper here and there. And you know, all these other sites like, Rocket Reach, this one, that one. You pay a little, you can get everybody's jail, imprisonment record, divorces, settlements, alimonies. I mean, it's endless. Therefore, I think banks, there are two things I would say about banks and other complex financial institutions. On the one hand, they are the active agents of this profiling process. On the other hand, they live in a shared world of understandings with their customers. Mm-hmm. That if you have bad credit, you have bad credit. Bad FICO, they agree, you agree, everybody agrees. Mm-hmm. But 20 years ago, there was no such score. How did this agreement happen? That is the social scientist question. How does something that didn't exist become normalized?
Yeah. As a whole individual, we somehow became numbers, become the data being collected into a system, and the system produced some sort of calculation, a way to compute us as data, and then reproduce a result to another set of data, another set of numbers as a representation of us. So, like, it's very important to pay large attention to what was missing, what went missing when human become numbers and then reproduce as numbers and come back being decided as being having human conditions being decided again by those partial numbers. I think it's very important to understand what we're missing and what was produced in this whole process, which I think is one of the most important contribution that you put in the book. And thank you very much.
I appreciate your seeing that, because it is one of the things that's not fully developed in the book. But it's a direction that I'm pointing to. And underlying it are many other complex social issues, which go back also to earlier work like Ulrich Beck,
yes,
on the Risk Society. These are all important for me contributions. But the most abstract way to put it is how there is a new set of equations between quality and quantity. So the number part somehow is extracted from something qualitative and then brought back to that. So the banker who sees you asking for a loan at the end will address you as an individual.
Mm.
But meanwhile, you have been cut, chopped, sliced, datafied, represented, crunched in the back office by 10 guys who know how to do the crunching. Then they tell the quants, tell somebody in the management, who then tells the guy in the front office who's talking to you.
Yes.
So at the end, it looks like an individual response where he will say to you, well, alas, we can't do this because... But at that point, quantity is retranslated into quality, but it's a kind of fake translation because you've been processed and processed and processed in the numerical machine. So I think that is our dilemma, how to reclaim, if you like, quality, and not only as the old idea of individual, but somehow in a new relational world.
Mm.
Where you can say, yes, I'm also scored, you are also scored, I'm also a debtor, you're also a debtor, but let's join forces. So Occupy Wall Street, which I'm generally critical of, I don't think it was a very successful idea, had that good idea. You're a debtor, you can get together with other debtors and, as it were, protest the banking order.
We also pass on those reflections and questions to our audience and the future generations of social scientists. We hope this conversation can help to a broader perspective to push on this very pressing, important issues that you pointed, framed out in the book for researchers of different regions and also for the audience of everyday life to reflect on their specific context and looking for grants to build solidarity and together to change the system. And thank you very much for giving us the inspirations. It's my pleasure to host you today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks to you and to the team, our colleagues here, for making this such a smooth and happy process for me, and a very fruitful one in terms of revisiting my own ideas, because of course as time passes, you know, you see things a bit differently, or you see the same things but from a different angle. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Padurai.
We end this episode with a quote picked by our host, Hairojin. In the world of contemporary finance, this discontinuity between our atomized selves over time is not seen as a profound ethical problem. Rather, it is treated as a massive opportunity for reassembling these divided bits of the person into various forms of financial subject tractable to the making of financial profit. Banking on Words, Chapter 4, page 68, by Arjun Appadurai. Thank you for listening.